Welcome everybody to the Fraser Lecture. Now, Clifford Geertz, our speaker tonight, really is somebody who needs no introduction. Sorry to start in such a boring way. He's an anthropologist, but also a humanist, a thinker, a social philosopher, and one can also definitely say a writer, a literary analyst, a rhetorician. So, in fact, he is the one, perhaps, anthropologist whose work is so widely known outside anthropology. He's someone whose distinctive voice is part of the intellectual world we live in. In fact, looking him up on the web this morning, I discovered there to be 33,900 entries under his name. And as a student in our department said the other day, is it the Geertz who's coming? Does he really exist? So I won't bore and give the briefest indication of his work. Clifford Geertz has conducted extensive ethnographical research in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, North Africa, Morocco. He's, of course, made a great contribution to cultural theory. He's been very influential, of course, in turning anthropology towards a concern with interpretation, the frames of meaning within which various peoples live their lives. He's worked on religion, particularly Islam, on trade in bazaars, on economic development, on traditional political structures, and on family life. And at present, I believe he's working on the general question of ethnic diversity and its implications in the modern world. Now, the Fraser Lecture, which we have today, was established to honour Sir James Fraser, the author of The Golden Bough, in the four universities he was associated with: Glasgow, Liverpool, Cambridge and Oxford. Here in Cambridge, the lectures come to the Department of Social Anthropology. Now, Geertz is known primarily as a cultural anthropologist. Does this matter? As a lot of you will appreciate, society and the social has undergone something of a sort of eclipse, and it's become an idea that people hardly really dare write about, except in inverted commas. And culture, really, too, one could say, has a troubled existence. But I think anthropology has moved on to encompass and transcend such distinctions, and particularly, perhaps above all, in the study of religion, which we're going to hear about today. So the title of today's talk is Shifting Targets, Moving Aims on the Anthropology of Religion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abbey, for that introduction. I'm very pleased to be here. I am honored to be giving this lecture. Thank you all for showing up. For an anthropologist pushing 80 and feeling it push back, there seems little to do on a ceremonial occasion of this sort, dedicated as it is to commemorating a memorial figure whom most people remember, so far as they remember him at all, as a cloistered Edwardian don who devoted his life to a Kosovan-like compilation of the world's exotica. But to reflect upon one's own, rather different, but hardly less transient, career in a related line of work, and try to suggest what time and change have done to it. Not that this will avail against what time and change have done and will continue to do to it. There is nothing so dead as a dead academic, and any Ozymandian dreams one might entertain will be quickly dissolved by the simple device of looking up the collected Fraser Lectures 1922-32 on the Amazon website bestseller list and find them placed at 2,467,068. I hope, without undue self-reference or illusions of permanence, simply to put into the record a particular encounter with a particular time. and a particular subject, the anthropology of religion. Why I have spent so much of my time and energy since wandering into anthropology from the humanities, studying in heavy quotation marks here and throughout religion in Southeast Asia, in North Africa, in the past, in the present, increasingly in the world at large, it's not entirely clear to me, particularly as I have myself no particular religious background, and so far anyway, as I say, it's getting late, commitment. Some of it, this concern, not to say obsession, with faith, worship, belief, sanctity, mystery, worldview, sorcery, propitiation, and the adoration of trees, on which you will remember Fraser has no less than 5 separate chapters, certainly has to do with that humanities background. Literature and philosophy do incline the mind to recherche subjects. But far more, I think it is due to the continuing centrality of the description and analysis of myth, magic, rite, and spiritual tonality in anthropology. From E.B. Tyler, William Robertson Smith, R.R. Marin, and Fraser, forward through Bronislaw Malinowski, Raymond Firth, E.E. Evans Pritchard, Godfrey Lienhart, Victor Turner, and Mary Douglas, to essay only a local Oxbridge, London, and Manchester genealogy. My own genealogy is, of course, American, Ruth Benedict, Gladys Reichard, Robert Redfield, Clyde Cluckum. Along with kinship, with which, via totemic classification and the incest taboo, it was directly linked from the beginning, religion has been so much at the center of anthropological thought that anyone concerned, as I was and am, with the emblems and insignia of the human way of being in the world, would immediately be drawn to it as a field of research. And so when the powers at Harvard, having organized a group of graduate students to go to Indonesia on a team project to study kinship, village life, peasant marketing, the Chinese shopkeeper minority, and local government, found themselves in need of someone to, quote, do religion, I jumped at the chance and wrote my doctoral thesis in my first book on the interplay of Islamic, Hindu-Buddhist, and Malayo-Polynesian currents in the spiritual life of the Javanese. And I've been worrying over the complexities and puzzlements encountered, theoretical ones, empirical ones, philosophical ones, sectarian ones, perhaps most important, practical ones, ever since. Thinking back, not to that particular project or my work there as such, both of which are by now more or less archival, but to the whole period, the immediate post-World War II incipient Cold War 1950s, it seems clear to me, and I think in general, that there was about that time a major shift in both the aims and the objects of the anthropological study of religion, in what it was looking at and what it was looking for. Virtually all previous forays had been into tribal or archaic beliefs and ceremonies. Australia, the ancient Semites, Native America, the Trobriands, the Nilots, the Chukchi, with the assumption, implied or open, that rudiments and foreshadowings of Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, and the other so-called, quote, high religions could be seen there, and thus the elementary forms of the religious life, in Emile Durkheim's famous slogan, could be defined, classified, and reduced to rule. Now, however, an effort got underway to address the, quote, high religions directly, and in their immediate and contemporary emotionalistic forms, less to ferret out their common features than to place them within the social and historical, dare I say, in this venue, cultural context within which they emerged and upon which they acted. What had been comparative folklore in search of parallels and prefigurations, shamans as priests, cockfights as sacraments, regicide as redemption, what Fraser called our debt to the savage, became a comparative ethnography in search of consequence, import, impact, significance, weight. How precisely and how much does religion matter in the ongoing course of things? Wherein lies its appeal and force, its reach, its persistence? What, as we soon came to put it, is it? The imagery, the discipline, the fervor, the theatrics, the obsessiveness, the storytelling, all about. This turn, or move or paradigm shift was, of course, but part and a minor part of that, of a more general shift in anthropological attention away from jungles, deserts, and Arctic wastes to what became to be known as the New Nations, the developing countries, the Third World, the emerging powers, or the non-aligned states. Someone setting out to study India or Iran, Nigeria, Egypt, China, or Brazil, or as I was, Indonesia, found themselves faced not with an anthill assemblage of myths, spirits, and psychical practices to label and sort out, but with massive, deeply historical and conceptually elaborated social and cultural formations, complete with officials, texts, economies, and ratified names. Complex societies, civilizations, if you wish, some of them as large as subcontinents, with multicultural populations, bundles of languages, and spiritual connections across half the world, presented those of us who trained on Bengay and Blessing Way came to be engaged with them not just with a new object of study, but with a revised conception of how to study it and of what it was we wanted to find out. So far as Java, that anthology of the world's best imperialisms, poised to become the nucleus of a rambling and precarious, conceptually ill-defined political entity, was concerned, this meant, in the first instance, a recognition forced upon one by the merest contact with local life of adversative, religiously phrased divisions within a single, many-minded society. And in the second instance, that these divisions and this many-mindedness did not preclude, but in fact produced, a distinct and particular sort of spiritual temper, a bent, a humor, a moral climate. If the function of religion, as we were still caught then to say in those days, was the tuning of the ultimate value attitudes of the society, the tuning here was various, contrastive, and contrapuntal. And so were the attitudes. Well, Denis Lombard, the Brodelian historian of Le Cage Avenay, called Le Carrefour des Réseaux Asiatiques, precariously balanced between le fanaticism and la tolérance, between les frictions de la concurrence and la volonté de l'harmonie, turned out to be an excellent site on which first to take apart the very idea of religion and then to try somehow to put it back together again. The conceptual equipment available for performing this sleight of hand, separating out clashing and discontinuous spiritual currents, and then reconnecting them in the muddled composite flow of everyday life, was sparse and cursory. All these things, pluralism, syncretism, communalism, denominationalism, sectarianism, the received terms for describing competing traditions animating common situations, all seemed inadequate to the tumbling intricacy and intensity of things. The suspicions and jealousies, along with the headlong aspirations to national unity, that drove the early Republic of Indonesia, and before long came within inches or hours of destroying it, were far wider and all-embracing than even the metaphorically or analogically religious. And yet they were, those suspicions and those jealousies, and the aspirations as well, colored and reinforced at almost every point by worldview variations centuries in the making. It was not so much the ingredient traditions, Hinduism, or as some of them call Java, Hindu Buddhism, which had been there from the 9th century, Islam, which had entered in the 14th and 15th, Christianity, propagated by European missionaries and plantation managers in the 18th and 19th, and the Austronesian undercurrent, which remained visible in the witchery and spiritism of popular observance, that most challenged description and explication. They were recognizable, familiar, not all that distinctive, the usual grist for the ethnographical mill. It was the way in which those traditions and the mentalities they generated were stretched taut across the deepest and most divisive fissures of social, political, and economic life, and in fact defined and constructed those fissures, shaped them, sustained them, drove them on, that demanded a methodological change of plan. The details of how all this worked out, in quote, in reality, are again on the record. The progressive polarization of these closed and hardened castes of mind, and as the passions of the Cold War intruded upon the local scene and attached themselves like so many ideological parasites to one or another of them. The foundering of electoral politics and parliamentary government as the polarization advanced to all-out culture war. The eruption of mass violence, hundreds of thousands dead, when factional killing broke out along these lines across the whole of the island. The causes of all this and of the forced and artificial reintegration which followed it kept the country in a state of political and intellectual suspension, a sort of cultural time warp for 35 years, were of course various. But that the crash and clatter of religious dispositions was prominent among them is quite clear. As I say, this sort of difficult intricacy, the interplay of local traditions and world religions, confronted not just myself and my Java Project colleagues thrown into the middle of a forming country, it confronted the whole generation of anthropologists who turned in the 1950s and 60s to the study of old societies trying to become new, or anyway newer, states. India, with the communalist division of its nationalist movement and agonies of partition, was perhaps the most spectacular case. But Nigeria, with its Islamico-Christian sectionalism and its ethno-evangelical civil war, Sri Lanka, with its Sinhalese Buddhist versus Tamil Hindu violence, interreligious discordance and suspicions and moral distancings in Latino-American, Mesoamerica, Sunni Shi'i sectarianism of small differences in Iraq and Pakistan, Orthodox Roman ones in Serbo-Croatia, Muslims, Christians, and Jews tumbled together across the Middle East and North Africa, lowland Buddhist and upcountry Christianity glowering at one another in Burma, Spanish Catholicism, American evangelism, and Islamic revivalism jammed together and set apart in the island Philippines. All of these, and lots of other examples, presented anyone concerned to explore their spiritual constitution with a rather different sort of task than that which had faced Rio Fortune and his sorcerers in Dobu, Max Gluckman and his chiefs in Swaziland, or Claude Lévi-Strauss and his jaguar stories among the Bororo. The first question it raised, and the one most productive of abstract debate, is one that was, of course, tacitly there from the very beginning, but which could, now that such variousness, multiplicity, rivalry, and clamor were involved, no longer and silently and unreflectedly be answered by the simple device of training our attention to cults and customs that seemed at least generally analogous to ones in our own society to have something to do with the divine, the supernatural, the holy, the sacred, the numinous, the transcendent. Namely, what is religion? What is to be included under this rubric? Where are its borders? What are its marks? When you get down to it, is belief or worship or observance or faith? My dissertation was called Religions in Java. The book that emerged from it, cut, polished, and renamed for public consumption, was called The Religion of Java. It had sections on everything from religious shadow plays, the Hajj, yoga, and speech styles, to possession, Quranic chants, Quranic schools, and Quranic chants, funeral feasts, and political parties. It is still not clear what its subject was. The issue here, how are we to name and classify cultural formations in other societies that are at once broadly similar to ones in our own, and yet oddly sui generis, strange, at once strange and different, is, of course, general in anthropology, a recurrent crux. Whether it is the family, the market, or the state, or law, or art, or politics, or status, all these things in quotes, deciding just what goes into the category, as we say, cross-culturally, and why it does so, is an essentially contested matter. A circular discussion that stirs polemic, never ends, and only marginally, and then rather diagonally advances. The usual tack is to begin with our own, more or less unexamined, everyday of sense of what the family, the state, or in this case at hand, religion, comes to. What counts for us as kinship, or government, or faith, and what family resemblance style looks, well, resemblant among those whose life ways we are trying to portray. This hardly results in a determinate species and genera taxa, Linnaean catalog of cultural kinds. What it results in is a persistent issue over which adults need to argue, the definition problem. What do we talk about when we talk about religion? In good part, surely what we talk about is, quote, meaning. If there is any general, immediate, and, at least until it's looked into more carefully, perspicuous category, direct and intuitive, apparently coherent, under which the Cabbages and Kings material of ethnographic accounts of religion in today's potpourri New State societies can be comparatively subsumed, it is that. The oblique family resemblance connections between the sorts of phenomena, beliefs, practices, attitudes, imaginings, that we group casually and unreflectively, ordinary language-wise, under the common sense designation religion for ourselves, and those we so group hardly more deliberatively in connection with societies we see at least somewhat distant and unlike to our own as, quote, other, are essentially ones we regard in either case as having something critically to do with the overall purpose, point, sense, significance, or things, with broadly and momentously, often enough parabolically and rhetorically, the meaning of life. Put that way, it might seem that all we succeeded in doing is replacing one obscurity with another, the indefinite with the indistinct. But there is, or so it seemed to me, as I struggled to determine what it was I've in fact trying to bring to integral description in the Javanese case, one advantage of refocusing matters in such a way. Namely, that a large and expanding set of precise and powerful speculative instruments, conceptions, theories, perspectives, modes of discourse, frames of analysis, had been emerging in the human sciences, which can and could be mobilized to sort the insortable, connect the unconnected, to define researchable questions and devise ways actually to research them. Putting anthropology, and most specifically the anthropology of religion, into the conceptually more complex and self-conscious context of contemporary linguistics, literary criticism, semiotics, psychology, sociology, and most especially philosophy, is not to obscure what it has to say with imported abstractions or pump it up with concocted jargon. It is, in Charles Peirce's famous advisement, to try to make our ideas clear, not least to ourselves. In the flood of work that has appeared since, shall we say, Peirce, Fernando Saussure, Gottlob Frege, and Drelman Jakobsen, who seem to me in there to have, in their several ways, started most of it off. With respect to the analysis of what simply to have a covering term we could call meaning systems, or as I came to prefer, cultural systems, three lines of thought seem to me of particular value in connection with focusing and ordering our comparative understanding of religion. The first of these is what has been called the autonomy of meaning thesis. The phrase is due to the American philosopher Donald Davidson, but the locus classicus formulation is Wittgenstein's, no interest name needed there, private language argument. Meaning is not a subjective matter, private, personal, in the head. It is a public and social one, something constructed in the flow of life. We traffic in signs en plein air, out in the world where this action is. And it is in that trafficking that meaning is made. We must, as Stanley Cavell, another American philosopher with Wittgensteinian tendencies, has with appropriate paradox put it, mean what we say, because it is only by saying, or otherwise behaving, acting, proceeding, conducting ourselves in an intelligible manner, that we can mean at all. The second thought line, implicate in the first, is that meaning is materially embodied, that it is, and here one searches for the appropriate term, formed, conveyed, realized, emblematized, expressed, communicated via ponderable, perceptible, construable signs. Symbolical devices like passage rites or passion plays, differential equations or impossibility proofs, which are its vehicles. What makes passing a device religious is not its structure, but its use. Pythagoreans, we are told, worship right triangles in the square root of 2. Despite the difficulty of formulating in a simple, straightforward way, something due to the haunting of our language by the ghosts of departed epistemologies. This is a more or less obvious idea. Once those ghosts, Platonic or Cartesian, Comtean or Christian, are properly exorcised. That culture, language, art, science, law, religion, marriage, politics, merriment, common sense, the whole kit and caboodle, consists not of bodiless ideas suspended in impalpable mental states, delicate motions of the soul and spirit, but of what the American action theorist, social critic, and all-round man of letters, Kenneth Burke has called equipment for living. Equipment that is substantial, at hand, usable, and used. This ought now to be not so difficult a notion. And finally, connecting all this more directly with religion and worship, there has been the development important in the human sciences, at least since Max Weber's Religion und Soziologie, but which has a long and serpentine history in apologetical speculation of all shapes and varieties, and in certain branches of recent theology, the conception of limit or ultimate or existential problems of meaning. The notion that is at the point at which our cultural resources fail, or begin to fail, where our equipment for living creaks and threatens to break down in the face of the radically inexplicable, the radically unbearable, or the radically unjustifiable, irresolvable confusion, ineluctable pain, invisible evil, the primitive surge of finitude, that the sort of concern often enough self-referred to as ultimate we recognize as religious comes into play. Man can adapt himself somehow, Susan Langer, another unclassifiable freelance American social theorist has written in the passage I have cited elsewhere more than once. Man can adapt himself somehow to anything his imagination can cope with, she writes, but he cannot deal with chaos. Our most important assets, she goes on, are always the symbols of our general orientation in nature, on earth, in society, and in what we are doing. The symbols are our Weltanschauung and Lebensschauung. In a primitive society, she continues, with daily rituals incorporated in our common activities, in eating, washing, fire making, because the need of reasserting the tribal morale and recognizing its cosmic conditions is constantly felt. In Christian Europe, the church brought men daily, in some hours even hourly, to their knees to enact, if not to contemplate, their ascent to the ultimate concepts. That's in the quote. Equipped then with these three general notions, that meaning is autonomous, that it is conveyed in signs or symbols, and that religious meanings so conveyed are directed toward points at which impasse looms, I tried just about 40 years ago now, and curiously enough, on a stage here in Cambridge, at a famous Hands Across the Sea ecumenical conference designed to gather young British, quote, social and younger American cultural anthropologists into a common discourse community. Little hope, apparently, was held out for their elders, most of whom avoided the event. I tried to set forth a brief and general account of, quote, religion as a cultural system, or again, meaning system, by means of which I hoped I could identify and locate the center of gravity, so far as there was one, in my dispersed and ad hocish, engage it first and interpret it later, approach to things. This involved, in the first instance, a tentative, rather awkward, rather diffuse effort to construct a definition, not as I thought I explicitly, quite explicitly and insistently, even repetitiously stated, not to isolate an ontological, universalistic, trans-historical essence of religion for now and always, to quote a series of epithets from a critic, but to control, guide, and render more explicit and, at that time anyway, still rather angular and unfamiliar line of argument. This roadmap, d'horizon definition, it was really more of a provocation than anything else, directed toward upending the complacencies at once of structuralism and functionalism than the reigning paradigms in ethnological research, was mainly concerned with stressing the way in which our peoples, or groups, or individuals, those comprehensive ideas of order, their worldview, and the pervading tone and temper of their life, their ethos, are made to complete and reinforce one another in religious practice, in ritual and myth, in spiritual discipline, in the reflexive pieties of everyday life. Religion, to quote myself now, tunes human actions to envisage cosmic order and projects images of cosmic order onto the plane of human experience. It gives, as the epigraph I took from George Santayana's Neglected Reason and Religion put it, a particular idiosyncratic bias to life, constructs, as a believer myself, I suppose, discovers, another world to live in. And quoting Santayana again, another world to live in, whether we expect ever to pass wholly over into it or no, is what we mean by having a religion. In any case, having thus collected my thoughts as best I could manage for the moment and set them out for the powers to contemplate, I rather quickly tired of position taking and polemical exchange, the here we are and there we are of programmatical discourse in scholastical places, and wanted to return to the mind face where, once again, the action is, after all, to see if all this came to anything useful and understand, as we say, the real world, the one which people live in and anthropologists only visit. Accordingly, I began yet another long-term, up-close encounter with another historically old, politically new, or anyway renovated, religiously emphatic society. Job at that time was fully in the throes of that pandemic violence I mentioned earlier, namely Morocco. Like Java, or Indonesia, but let's leave that problem aside, Morocco is, of course, nominally publicly, or at least semi-officially, quote, Islamic, and has been for the whole of its written history, and seems highly unlikely soon to change. But unlike Java, it is Arabo-Berber, rather than Malayo-Polynesian, in its ground-based infraculture. And unlike Java, it has been largely, not entirely, but largely, free of direct involvements with and intensive influences from other high world organized doctrinal or scriptural religions. There was for a very long time an enclave Jewish presence, and for a much shorter time a supervenient Christian one, but neither had much effect on the overall drift and tenor of things. As a result, instead of the diffuseness and conglomeration, the sense of eclecticism, dispersion, and continuous position taking which marks Java, Morocco presents a much severer, much more focused and concentrated spiritual picture, Islam sans phrase. Against Java's delicate colorful balance between les frictions de la concurrence and la volonté de l'harmonie, Morocco seems, in temper at least, its social structure is another matter, direct, uncluttered, spare, and monophonic. To bring this contrast out and unpack it, and to demonstrate the usefulness of the meaning system approach to focusing issues, I gave a series of rather brief, schematical, and in some ways reductive lectures after returning from North Africa in the late 1960s, in which rather than offering an encyclopedic survey of whatever seemed to have something or other to do locally with religion, as I had for Java, I attempted to trace how a singly long-established, highly codified, extraordinarily self-conscious, not to say self-absorbed, world religion, that is Islam, had worked itself out in quite different ways, with quite different effects, in quite different settings, the farthest Maghrib, the most distant Indies. Published later as Islam Observed, which was supposed to be a pun, though I don't know that anyone noticed, my discussion was organized around the construction in each of these two societies of what I call their classical styles of religious expression. In Java, a hierarchical, syncretistic, rather diffuse, experience-seeking intuitionism. In Morocco, a strenuous, confrontational, and rather puristic, world-correcting moralism. The validity of these capsule characterizations aside, it's not possible in such matters to describe without misdescribing, exception and contradiction are so deeply built in. My concern was to show how comprehensive overall ideas of order, some of them derived from Islamic texts and traditions, some of them not, and particular locally developed, locally accented social practices played into one another, dialectically, if you like that sort of language, reciprocally if you don't, to produce concrete and particular trans-divisive distinctive ways of being in the world. But a funny thing happened on the way to the argument. In both countries, and it soon became apparent in the world at large, the closeness of the tie between large views and local circumstances began to grow drawn and attenuated, transformed to a plane of abstract defensiveness and identity panic, even as I watched. What had been a fairly direct and immediate interplay between the everyday experience of life among others, and deep-laid notions of significance and collective purpose became, at least for large and growing segments of the two populations, though again in characteristically contrastive ways, a much more elusive, intricate, unsteady, and uncertain manner. To name this phenomenon, and in part to characterize it, though its force and scale as well as staying power remained then quite unclear, I coined for the nonce phrase, religious mindedness. Quote myself for a moment. In the course of their separate social histories, I wrote, the Moroccans and the Javanese created, partly out of Islamic traditions, partly out of others, images of ultimate reality in terms of which they both saw life and sought to live it. Like all religious conceptions, these images carried with them their own justification. The symbols, rites, doctrines, objects, events through which they were expressed were, for those responsive to them, intrinsically coercive, immediately persuasive. They glowed with their own authority. It is this quality that they seem gradually to be losing, at least for a small and growing minority. What is believed to be true is not changed for these people, or not changed much. What has changed is the way in which it is believed. Ends that quotation. Whatever you want to call it, and as I say, religious mindedness does not seem to me quite the right term, for it suggests a certain superficiality and falling away from genuineness, which I don't think was the case, or is the case. There seemed in both countries to be a change, then still limited but rapidly accelerating, in the way in which religious convictions were brought together with the workings of everyday life. The relations between the two were less simple, less immediate, and less direct, more in need of explicit, conscious, organized support. The forms in which this took in both countries, back to the Quran reformist movements, political party organization of religious interests, the effervescence of propaganda, apology, and doctrinal argument, brought nothing so much to mind as another line from Santayana, this one about persons, he called them fanatics, but that too isn't quite right, who, having lost the sight of their aim, redouble their effort. A great deal has happened, both in Indonesia and Morocco, particularly in the Islamic world generally, since those lectures were developed in what turned to be the Opera Nulle de Lugier of 1967. Indonesia has had four presidents since, two of them strong Muslims, two of them more syncretic in outlook. Morocco has had two kings, one of them emphatic and hard-handed, the other hesitant, elusive, and hard to read. The Cold War, which pumped foreign-born ideological passions into homegrown social tensions to the point where the combination threatened to disintegrate politics and dismantle the state, has ended. There were only a few Jews left of what was once a flourishing, besieged community in Morocco. Indonesia's rather nativistic Communist Party, once the largest outside the Sino-Soviet bloc and poised for revolution, has been completely destroyed after a failed coup and a popular massacre, its leaders killed, imprisoned, exiled, or disgraced. And perhaps most important from the point of view of our subject, the religious mindedness versus religiousness as such, self-conscious doctrinarian belief as opposed to everyday reflexive faith, that I saw just beginning to become prominent in the two countries as Salafism, scripturalism, reformism, purism, and double-mindedness, to use terms I'd used, has since become pervasive across the whole of the Muslim world under such generalizing rubrics as Islamism, political Islam, neo-fundamentalism, and jihadist Islam. Khomeini, the Front Islamic du Salut, the Taliban and Osama have occurred since. So have the Al-Aqsa Intifada, the attack on the World Trade Towers, the American invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, the bombings of Bali and Casablanca, the de-Sovietization of China, of Central Asia, and the massive migration, increasingly permanent, increasingly contested, of Near Eastern and Asian Muslims into Western Europe and the United States. Such, indeed, are the perils of trying to write history as it happens, as I was in part attempting to do. The world will not stand still till you complete your paragraph, and the most you can do with a future is sense its imminence. What comes, comes. The important thing is whether when it comes, it makes any sense as an outgrowth of the directive processes you think you have seen. History, it has been said, may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And from that point of view, looking back from what I see now to what I saw then, though I am both worried and disheartened, I hope for better, I don't feel particularly embarrassed, chastened, defensive, or apologetic. Sensing rain, I may have gotten a flood, but it was at least a corroborative one. However informed and gathering the clouds were then, and however uncertain I was about what to make of them, they were real. And so, it now turns out, was the storm they portended. In the second half of the 20th century, the long post-war, the study of religion and social sciences was, with a few prominent exceptions, Peter Bergman, Thomas Luckman, Robert Bell in sociology, Victor Turner and Mary Douglas in anthropology, still pretty much of a backwater. And the reductive version of the so-called secularization thesis that the rationalization of modern life was pushing religion out of the public square, shrinking it to the dimension of the private, the inward, the personal, and the hidden, was in full cry. Though spirits and goblins and even high gods still had purchase among peripheral peoples and submerged classes, and the churches remained open, the illusion had no future as a broadly consequential social force. It might, indeed, probably would, persist for a while in this place or that as a primitivist hangover or a drag on progress, but they would ever again have the directive power, forcible and transformative in its social, political, and economic affairs that it once had been in the Reformation, the Middle Ages, or the Axial Age, was scarcely conceivable. That, of course, may still turn out to be the case, and Weber's nightmare, specialists without spirit, centralists without heart, yet come to pass. But it didn't look like that to me or my out-of-step fellow travelers in 1967, and it certainly doesn't look like that to anyone now. Hindutva, neo-evangelism, Gage Buddhism, Eretz Israel, liberation theology, universal Sufism, charismatic Christianity, Wahhabi, Shi'ism, Qutb, and the return of Islam. Assertive religion, active, expansive, and bent on dominion is not only back, the notion that it was going away in significant streaking, its force dissolving, seems to have been, to put it mildly, premature. Summing up in a handful of sentences what has happened to religion here, there, and around the world in the closing decades of the last century and the opening ones of this is, of course, quite impossible, mug's game, and after what I've been through, I have better sense than to attempt it. But it is possible to suggest a few characteristics of the contemporary scene, within Morocco and Indonesia as well as without, within Islam as well as with the other world religions, that seem to be at once something rather new under the sun and logical extensions of settled trends. Of these I will mention here only two, though they are but part of a much larger picture, and they rather come down to two ways of saying the same thing. One, the progressive disentanglement, for want of a better word, of the major religions, some of the minor ones, Soka Gakkai, Mormonism, Kaudai, Baha'i, from the places and peoples and social formations and sites and civilizations within which and in terms of which they were historically formed, Hinduism and Buddhism from the deep particularities of Southern and Eastern Asia, Christianity from those of Europe and the United States, Islam from those of the Near East and North Africa, and two, the emergence of religious persuasion, inherited or self-ascribed, thinned out or reinforced as a broadly negotiable, mobile and fungible instrument of public identity, a portable persona. The spread of named and textualized world religions from their point of origins of most immediate relevance to foreign climes and contexts is, of course, a matter of very long standing. That is why they're called world religions. The missionary expeditions of Protestantism into Asia and Africa, the migration of Roman Catholicism along with Iberian conquest culture into Latin America, Islam's explosive thrust east and west from its backwater Arabian heartland, even the rather more elusive, harder to trace radiation of Buddhism out of India into China, Japan, and Southeast Asia, or that of rabbinic Judaism out of the Near East into Spanish, Slavic, and Germanic Europe. All these demonstrate that beliefs, faiths, Weltanschauungen, religions travel, change as they travel, and work themselves with varying degrees of success and permanence into the finest of fine structure of the most local of local histories. What is new in the immediate situation, or anyway different enough to represent something of a sea change, is that whereas earlier moments of religious conceptions and their attendant commitments, practices, and identifications was largely a matter of centrifugal outreach in one form or another, missionization, conquest, calico trade proselytizing, and colonial intrusion, itinerant clerks, outpost academies, in situ conversions. The present movement is both larger and more various, more general dispersion than a series of directed flows. The migration, temporary, semi-permanent, and permanent, of everyday believers of this variety and that, this intensity or that, across the globe. There are estimated 20 million Indians living outside of India, 5 million Muslims living in France. There are Buddhists, Thai, Burman, Sri Lankan, as well as some autopoetical ones in London and Los Angeles, Christians, Western expatriate ones in Tokyo, Riyadh, and Bangkok, Filipino guest worker ones in the Gulf, Australia, and Hong Kong. There are Murid street peddlers from Senegal and Turin, Turkish and Kurdish grocers in Berlin. Latin American Indo-Catholics will soon outnumber, if they don't already, Euro-American ones in the United States. The world, in a phrase I quoted years ago from Alphonse Lamartine when I was always getting started and I was just beginning to get interested in the ideologization of religion, of religious traditions, has jumbled its catalog. This scattering, piecemeal, headlong, fitful, and except for a certain amount of kinship and neighborhood chaining, unorganized, of individuals and families into locally rooted, culturally particularized settings, alters the whole climate of public belief and spiritual self-consciousness, both for those who move and for those into whose midst they move, as well as for those who are left behind. The formation of diaspora communities, even religiously marked diaspora communities, are also hardly a wholly new phenomenon in world history. Jews in New York, Maronites in West Africa, Hadramautis in Southeast Asia, Gujaratis in the Cape. But the scale on which they now are forming, 50,000 Moroccans in Amsterdam, 100,000 Malians in Paris, 150,000 Bangladeshis in London, 2 million Turks in Berlin, virtually all arrived there in the last two or three decades, surely is. It is not just capital that's being globalized, not just doctrine that is spreading. The transformation of more or less routinely transmitted, compliantly received conceptions of the good, the true, and the actual into expressly exerted, vigorously promoted, and militantly defended ideologies, the move from religiousness to religious-mindedness of various sorts and degrees of intensity, that was, quote, observed as getting underway in Morocco, Indonesia, and Islam in the middle 60s, as those countries began seriously to reconsider their religious history, is now a quite general phenomenon in a world where more and more people themselves they have inherited are, so to speak, out of context, thrown on, among others, in ambiguous, irregular, polyfaith settlements. It is not just Muslims, and not just North Africans and Southeast Asians, who are undergoing this sort of spiritual reorientation, nor is it happening only in migrant populations. The jumbling of the world's catalog is altering both the form and the content of religious expression, and altering them in characteristic and determinate ways, changing at once the tonalities of conviction, its reach, and its public uses. That much, whatever else is or isn't happening, is quite clear. Being a Muslim abroad, or Hindu, or Christian, Jew, or Buddhist, but I return to my sheep, outside the Dar al-Islam, as it is, as increasing number of Moroccans and Indonesians going elsewhere to work, study, tour, or marry, are finding out a rather different matter than being one at home. Going among non-Muslims induces in many, probably nearly all, a certain amount of conscious reflection, more or less anxious, on what being a Muslim in fact comes down to, on how properly to be one in a setting not historically prearranged to facilitate it. There can be, and there are, of course, a number of outcomes, an ecumenical watering down of belief to render it less offensive to a religiously pluralized or secularized environment, setting, a double-minded dividing of the self and the self's life into but vaguely communicated inward and outward halves, a turn toward a much more assertive and self-conscious Islamism in response to the perceived faithlessness of the new setting, and just about every possibility in between, including, of course, blind, unfettered, slaughterous rage. So, one nervously bonding about four countries for half a century, the other calm and immobile in his rooms in St. John's for a similar period. Are we, after all, Fraser and I, in the same business? Is he in my genealogy, and am I in his? Does a name connect us, a history run through us, a field embrace us? It is a very long way, it would seem, from the strange going-ons in the grove at Nemi, the grim, quoting from me now, the grim figure, the drawn sword, the priest murderer himself to be murdered, to the political agendas of the Salafi madrasas of central Java, or the legitimist ambitions of the Sharifian Zawiyas of northern Morocco, to say nothing of the "Can We Let Them Wear Headscarves" comedies of Civis Paris, or the "Can We Let Them Read Koran" ones of the Chapter and Verse North Carolina. Is the anthropology of religion a subject, like kinship or class or gender, an issue like the origins of agriculture or the evolution of the state, a discipline like paleontology, a specialty like sociolinguistics? It should be clear by now that, at least as far as I'm concerned, others may do as others wish, studying religions is not, and never has been, a single bordered, learnable and teachable, sum upable thing. It is, and always has been, a matter of sorting through various happenings variously encountered. Large public ones like national elections or international migrations, small intimate ones like household feasts or Quran chants, merely incidental parenthetical ones like a broken funeral or raided cockfight or a painted over house facade, all in an effort to determine how overall conceptions of what reality really is and particular ways of going about in it play into one another to sustain some sense that more or less anyway and on balance things make sense. The religion of Java, observed as long, and the jumble catalog of the long post-war are but chapters obliquely related, loosely successive, arbitrarily titled, in a fitful history of meaning-making. It is that, as I look back over Sukarno's Java, hectic with hope and disappointment, Hassan Deux's Morocco, half-emergent from Asabiya, feud and umfetish, and now the tumblings and scatterings of the postmodern post-millennium, which seems to run through the whole and make of it, after all, a confinable subject, something to regard steadily and whole. At each stage, in each place, on each occasion, one is presented with a wild multiplicity of individuals, groups and groups of groups, trying to hold their lives together in the face of change, circumstance, and Sartre's hell, one another. One doesn't, after all, so much examine religion, investigate it, or even research it, as to circumambulate it, skulking about at the edge of the grove, one watches it happen. We are, most of us now, not just anthropologists, folklorists, or connoisseurs of the odd and arcane, thus somewhat employed. The jumbling of the world's catalog is by now general to the point of near universality. Cheek by jowl contrast, not only of religious allegiance, but of ethnic background, race, language, community, place of origin, God knows what other allegiance or marking people may contrive to distinguish themselves from one another and persuade themselves of their own solidity. It is pervasive, not just in Western Europe and North America, toward which the migration has recently been the most marked, but also in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, drawn with increasing force and inevitability into the swirl of the world's variety. It is possible, of course, that all this here we are and there we are will in time sort itself out into large, neat, hermetic blocks of cultural commonality, what we used to imagine nations to be, will either emerge or be created new. But so far as I can see, there is precious little sign of it. Jumble is with us, late and soon. Thank you very much.